Welcome to the JACCP podcast. My name is Jerry Bauman, and I'm the editor of the Journal of the American College of Clinical Pharmacy. Today, we're talking with Dr. Mitchell Buckley. Dr. Buckley is Director of Medical Affairs at Inovia Specialty Therapeutics, and I think prior to that was a clinical pharmacist in the medical ICU at Banner University Medical Center in Phoenix. Dr. Buckley and his colleagues published a systematic review on the impact of the critical care pharmacist-led interventions on pain, agitation, and delirium in mechanically ventilated adults. It appears in the September 2023 issue of JACCP. Mitch, thanks for joining us today and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, first off, thank you very much for using systematic review methodology and the PRISMA guidelines. As you probably know, JACCP is encouraging these types of reviews. Your inclusion criteria for including studies in this systematic review were adults greater than 18 years of age, ICU patients requiring mechanical ventilation, and last, receiving continuous infusion analgesia or sedation. What was the logic in restricting your search to these criteria?
Yes, great question. So before I answer that specifically, I'm going to back up just a little bit. So this kind of project kind of stemmed from a project I was doing at Banner University Medical Center, was more kind of like a quality improvement project. So like many other institutions, we knew that we had opportunities, significant opportunities for improvement of managing not just sedation and analgesia, but the entire continuum of like pain, agitation, delirium, mobility, the entire bundle of mechanically ventilated patients. And so with that, we felt that at the institution that we had a prime opportunity where pharmacists could play a larger role in giving like some prescriptive authority, as well as being the lead on the quality improvement process to improve things at our institution. So kind of where this stemmed from was I was very curious to know what other institutions had published, if any, at that time, to see where pharmacy had an opportunity to establish an intervention, implement it, execute it, and then also see what kind of impact it had either on clinical outcomes or process outcomes. And so that's kind of where the brainchild kind of came from. And so with that being said, we decided to look at more specifically those patients that were vented and on continuous sedation and or analgesia, because we felt like those were the patients who are pretty relatively more complicated, and also where it gave pharmacists opportunity to kind of leverage their skill sets and knowledge to impact optimal sedation and analgesia management, specifically in patients who are requiring mechanical ventilation. So that's kind of where we kind of felt like we were trying to focus on. So clearly it's not inclusive of other opportunities where pharmacists were involved, let's say, for example, like procedural sedation, or if in patients who may have had more like bolus administrations for sedation and analgesia. We just felt like this was an opportunity where it was kind of a pragmatic approach for the average ICU patient, that they were administered sedation and analgesia that was more specifically continuous infusion. And again, just kind of reiterate that we tease that specific detail out because we felt like pharmacists play such a vital role in not just agent selection, dose optimization, but also kind of the approach that less is more and trying to like peel that off sooner than later to hopefully mitigate some of the adverse risks and effects of patients who were receiving more sedation and analgesia than they probably needed. So that's kind of where that's kind of stemmed from. So we were just kind of curious what the opportunities were for pharmacy interventions, what those were, and that's kind of where it led to the systematic review. We wanted to do a very detailed and thorough, robust job to get the information out of what pharmacists had done and the impact that that had, not just on process, but clinical outcomes. And so this is kind of where that project kind of came from, and then more specifically where we dialed in to that specific criteria for inclusion.
So I understand now. With this inclusion and search strategy, how many studies were eventually included in the review, and what were some of their characteristics?
Great question. Overall, we that met our inclusion criteria, we identified 9 studies overall. Of those, there was a lot of variability, so just kind of like high-level overview of what we found. Of those 9 studies, the majority of them, 6 to be exact, were retrospective in nature. And essentially what it did was just kind of compare like a before and after design. So in other words, the comparator group was before any pharmacy intervention or implementation of a clinical activity, whether it be education or audit feedback strategies to improve like the sedation and analgesia management. The others included one study prospectively implemented a pharmacist-led intervention with the retrospective control group. And then two studies were prospective quasi-experimental designs. So there was a little bit of variability from just a study design perspective. And of those three studies, as far as like the patient population in which it was focused on, varied also. But of those nine studies, three of them actually focused specifically just in a medical ICU. And then two studies were actually completed in a trauma or a trauma surgical ICU. The other studies, the remaining ones, were a little bit more variable. So they may have included several subspecialty ICUs. So like say, for example, it wasn't specific to medical, but maybe included say like medical and cardiac. Some may have included three subspecialty ICUs, for example, like say a surgical, medical, and a cardiac ICU. So there was a little bit of variability as far as the specific patient populations that they included. So a lot of variability. And then overall, the actual pharmacist interventions drastically varied also as well. And we can talk about that a little bit more later in detail, which I think is a good, important talking point as well.
So you also rated these nine studies that were included on the basis of quality. What process did you use to accomplish this, and what were the results?
So kind of sticking with best practices for Cochrane review for systematic reviews, because the ultimate goal was try to do a meta-analysis, but because of the variability, we just weren't able to make that a reality. So of these, we had an overall good quality rating for one of them. And then the remaining were either considered either fair. Five of the nine were considered fair, and three were considered poor. So we did use the NIH risk of bias tools. And the two tools, because of the differences in the study designs, there were two tools from the NIH that we ended up using. One of the tools that we used was specific for before and after studies. So essentially like kind of like pre and post. And the other tool from the NIH that we also used to assess the quality or the risk of bias was specifically geared more towards observational cohort and cross-sectional studies. Of those two of the studies that we had met that criteria in which that tool was utilized. So overall, the studies were fair, one being good, and then there were some that were kind of considered poor by the standards of a risk of bias. Still applaud the efforts and the of the investigators to kind of like show and highlight their interventions that they used for pharmacist intervention, specifically impacting sedation and analgesia.
Well, I think our listeners should probably be aware that those tools are available if they want to undertake reviews such as this. You mentioned that one of the studies was rated as good. Perhaps you could briefly summarize that study and why it sort of stood out.
The one study that does stand out was the publication by John Marshall in 2008, in which he kind of described pharmacy's role in sedation analgesia. And I would say the one thing that kind of like pulled this one out was overwhelmingly the sample size was a lot larger and more robust than some of the other studies. But that alone wasn't the only caveat. So one of the other things that kind of contributed to this was the statistical analysis perspective. And then also, in addition to that, the outcome measures were clearly described, they're validated, and they were reliable. And so that really kind of also contributed to the robustness of the study design. Again, not to take away from the other authors' publications, but this one in and of itself kind of met those other assessment criteria from the risk of bias assessment tool that kind of had this one elevate slightly above some of the others.
So one of, I think, your important findings in this review was the inconsistent impact of clinical pharmacy services on patient care, clinical outcomes. For the listeners, maybe you could give some examples and summarize what are the possible reasons for this finding.
That's an excellent point. And I think one of the things that the listeners can kind of take away is it's kind of a blessing and a curse. So if we were to collectively evaluate and pool this data, it would be nice if the intervention of the clinical pharmacist impacting sedation analgesia was a little bit more consistent, i.e. cookie cutter. That way we kind of measure to see like where those results when each individual study, when pooled, would it corroborate or refute the overall picture of the impact that pharmacists have. Unfortunately, what we also saw, which also might be good as well, because there are many different approaches that we found that from the investigators used, also might be good within a review article to also give other people who are reading this article other ideas as far as like opportunities that they could implement in their own practice. And that is actually good because there's so much of differences between clinical pharmacy practices from institution to institution. So one health system may not be able to pragmatically implement some of the strategies used in some of these publications, but maybe they can take one intervention that was described in one study and implement it maybe on a smaller scale. But to answer your question, as far as the variability within the interventions, I'll give you an example. There was one publication that implemented essentially like overnights, they noticed that there was a gap of pharmacy involvement. And so they already had a tele-ICU program like overnight, but it didn't consist of a PharmD. And so what they did was like compare the before and after of implementing a tele-ICU PharmD specifically in the evening and overnights and kind of measuring the impact that that would have more specifically in medical, cardiac, and surgical ICU patients. They were interested to know like what the impact specifically this study, they wanted to know the primary outcome of the sedation awakening trials and the spontaneous breathing trial rates. Did they change because of the implementation of a tele ICU PharmD specifically overnights? And they actually did find a benefit with that. Now they did have other responsibilities just rather than just focusing on sedation. But again, that's giving another clue that it was with that implementation, it was not only hitting an unmet need, but it was also positively impactful on carrying through optimal provision of pharmaceutical care, specifically with like sedation analgesia. So that was one specific, very focused and narrow approach that those investigators used. Again, an equally narrow and focused approach was these investigators got a little creative and the fact that they implemented trigger alerts. And for the listeners who may not be familiar with what a trigger alert is, essentially it's logic-based criteria. So in other words, it's a report or some sort of notification that the pharmacist gets rather than trying to go out and sift through every single EHR progress note to find problems. It was essentially focused on who might be at high risk of experiencing delirium. So for example, if the patient maybe was greater than an age of X and they're on a continuous infusion sedation that maybe exceeded a certain dosing range, then that would trigger the pharmacist to them at least bring to their attention to evaluate the patient to see like if the action was warranted. And so again, this was really focused and also kind of novel in the fact that they were figuring like they couldn't solve all the problems, but maybe by having this tool available, this would help bring to light patients who might be at higher risk where the pharmacists intervene, that would be kind of like a time effective and efficient approach to reduce ICU delirium rates. So those are two examples of very narrow and focused approaches. And some of the other authors and the other ones didn't really describe specific detail. They just said pharmacists were then expected to follow kind of like more protocolized sedation interventions. Unfortunately, they didn't go into specific detail step by step as far as like what specifically the PharmD was evaluating and what that action would do for consistency and standardization within that, not just study environment, but within that specific health system. So you can already hopefully appreciate some of the drastic variability as far as pharmacists' involvement and the scope of involvement within each investigation. So,
good, thanks. So last, going forward, after doing this review, What would you recommend for additional studies?
We as a profession, and more specifically for like pharmacists focused with a critical care practice, if we're going to establish the overall value that we bring to these patients, we know we have a lot to contribute. But I think in order to do that, there probably should be a little bit of more consistency. And so one of the things as far as like items that we could consider for future studies is being a little bit more standardized as far as the measures that we're using from study to study. So in the studies that I kind of highlighted, interestingly and unfortunately, the compliance rates alone, so more of a process outcome metric. A lot of studies didn't even look at what the compliance rates at their own institutions were. At least they did not report them in the publications of what the spontaneous awakening trials were, or the spontaneous breathing trials compliance rate either, or delirium screening. Were the individuals that were responsible at their respective institutions to conduct the delirium screening, like for example, like say a nurse, they did not report what the compliance rates for these. And these were really important because one, if they're not documenting, we don't know if they're doing it appropriately or not. And so I think that that's one important step is more specifically process outcomes should be reported. And that probably could be related very easily to the PADIS guidelines or if you're using the bundle approach. Are they documenting, for example, if somebody's on continuous infusion sedation and you're expected to do a spontaneous awakening trial, one, was it being documented that it's actually being done? And I think that's step one to show that that step is being conducted. And also, I think it's also ensuring that there's best practices being followed. That is one huge component is more looking at the process metrics. The other thing is also looking at from an outcome patient-centered approach, what those outcomes measured are. And so one of the things as far as like our inclusion criteria, I want to be very clear that we only included studies that reported mechanical ventilation duration. Now, this is one example of a lot of variability. You could argue that the ventilator days, do you just look at ventilator duration? Or do you look at mechanical ventilator free days? If you're asking me, it's probably should be more of a mechanical ventilator free day. And the reason why is because it's a composite endpoint of looking at not just the ventilator duration within their ICU stay, but the patient also has to be alive as well. And so I think that is also an important one specific like example of a patient-centered outcome, mechanical ventilation. They could also report like mortality and length of stay, but those are kind of possibly a little bit more difficult to control because it may be impactful that a lot of the stuff is going on with this specific patient that would impact their survival or how long that they're going to be in the ICU. So I think that those are important things that we should also be a little bit more consistent. But from a starting point perspective, we could easily look at mechanical ventilator free days as well as delirium rates. And then I think other important outcomes that we could look at are self-extubation rates, reintubation rates, the use of physical restraints. As you can imagine, if you're a patient or you have a loved one in the ICU and, you know, the sedation is not being optimized, then I think that, you know, rather than using restraints, you could easily use, say, like mittens rather than having the patient feel like they're handcuffed to the bed and potentially contributing to their agitation and or delirium. There's also characteristics, I think, that, again, from consistency for future studies is the utilization and the optimization of sedation and analgesia specifically for continuous infusions. So interestingly, a lot of these studies were aimed at improving sedation analgesia, but a lot of them did not describe the dose or the duration of the sedative and or opioid that was being used. Like say, for example, like fentanyl, they didn't overly describe in all of these studies, some of them, but the duration and the dose and the impact that that had on utilization for a pharmacist, I think is one thing that could easily be described and should be considered in future studies. And so I think also with that kind of brings the burning question as far as the pharmacist intervention. Is there a way to standardize that? And so I think that that is probably a loaded question because there's so many different opportunities and practice models out there that vary from institution to institution to get everybody on the same page to do the exact same thing, like a standardized practice. of how every pharmacist across the nation or even worldwide should be kind of have a like a common playbook of how they manage sedation. I think that's going to be a tall order. And that one might be a little bit more difficult, but I think as far as some of the things that you can control within future studies is kind of what I previously mentioned, the process and the patient-centered outcomes, at least measuring the same thing, irrespective of even if the interventions are not specifically quite the same or standardized in future studies. And I think this will help, again, paint a picture and start a narrative of the value story, which I think is also really important to highlight not just what we're capable of doing, but also to make the argument that these resources are very valuable and impactful for patient care when we're trying to like expand services or even gain more personnel to support optimal patient care. So that was kind of my long-winded approach of what I think we should do.
Well, very good. I do want to thank you, Mitch, for doing this podcast and having this conversation today, but also more importantly for contributing your work to the journal. So thank you again.
Well, thank you very much.